From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a
Donald Trump is the 45th president of the United States. His inaugural address sounded a lot like his campaign speeches, dark, nationalistic, and full of big promises to restore American greatness. And now he has to set about the work of making good on those promises. Welcome to a special inauguration Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. And our special guest is Mickey Kouse, longtime political blogger at KouseFiles.com. Welcome, everybody. So you could say the theme of Donald Trump's inaugural address was the people versus the powerful.
The establishment protected itself, but not the citizens of our country. Their victories have not been your victories. Their triumphs have not been your triumphs. And while they celebrated in our nation's capital, there was little to celebrate for struggling families all across our land. That all changes starting right here and right now. Because this moment is your moment. It belongs to you.
Now, remarkably, for somebody who talks so much, Donald Trump said that the time for big talk is over and now it's the time for action. So, Mickey, how did this speech make you feel?
Well, I was disappointed at first because there was no soaring poetry. It was just it's very sort of standard Steve Miller, Trump speechwriter campaign speech. But it sure sounded much better in that clip you just played, and it had some good qualities. Washington, D.C. needed taking down. It's an island of prosperity and a sea of misery, and at least until recently. There was very little I in the speech. It wasn't I. It was you. And there was some unity. There was a nice line about people staring at the night sky in Nebraska. I like that.
Katrina, what did you think?
I thought it was shameless, cynical, effective. Donald Trump is still campaigning. I don't know about Stephen Miller, but I thought it was Bannon-esque, Stephen Bannon-esque. It was right-wing populism mixed with nationalism, anti-establishment, very dark. But, you know, on Twitter, a lot of liberals are castigating Trump's American carnage dystopia as out of touch, too bleak. But I think, you know, Trump and Bernie Sanders in the primary today he spoke to the pain of the forgotten man and woman, as he described it. Rusted up factories, tombstones across our country. Now, he's got to own the problems, the pain, the plan. As he said, time for action. He's got to walk the walk, not just talk the talk. And I just don't see this Davos, Goldman Sachs retreat cabinet of billionaires, ideologues, swampy bottom feeders on board to advance the populist policies for the folks Trump aimed the speech at. And I could see, you know, if we don't see some action on trade, on jobs, bringing back jobs, lawn signs across this country, double cross Donald.
Rich, do you think this was a conservative speech?
No. I think it was a nationalist speech, and nationalism is traditionally a subset within conservatism. And I think the opening passage where he talked about how he wants to disempower Washington, D.C., goes to the overlap that he'll have with congressional Republicans and is a space where you'll see cooperation. But Trump overwhelmingly defines that goal as a populist goal to disempower a corrupt and ineffectual elite and establishment, whereas conservatives, again, that might be part of it, but it's overwhelming an ideological goal to reduce the power of government for its own sake. I think kind of the intellectual through line through the speech was a defense of the nation state as the best vehicle for defending the interests of its citizens and as a community writ large. And one of the things that the nation state does, in Trump's view, is protect us. That was a word he came back several times in various contexts. So it was a speech that was true to Trump, the way he talks and what he believes, but it wasn't a conservative speech.
He repeatedly used the phrase America First, which obviously has freighted connotations from people who wanted to stay out of World War II, isolationism that would have allowed the Nazis to gain power. He also used this construction about how American policy should be made solely in the interests of citizens of the United States. And I sort of have two sets of feelings about this. One is that these ideas have been often associated with movements that have ended in bad places. On the other hand, the idea that public policy of the United States should be made for the benefit of citizens of the United States is sort of obvious and feels like it should be uncontroversial, and I think gets at a real problem in global politics over the last few decades, which is that some international institutions, the European Union being a great example of this, even though obviously we don't participate, have often made decisions that seem fairly clearly against the national interest of their participants, and people are fed up about that. So what I wonder hearing that is how to channel that in a productive direction and say, you know, sometimes the U.S. government has not been acting in the best interest of U.S. citizens, and we need to change that without landing in the uglier places that can go.
He was mercifully brief in discussing America's engagement with the world. He sounded like a realist in the sense of saying that we're not going to impose the American model on other countries, but we're going to lead by, quote, shining example. I mean, that's something George Kennan, who was a great realist, spoke of, and George Washington, Entangling Alliances. And it's breaking ranks with the increasingly vocal war party in D.C. And I think their think tankers and establishment figures across D.C. are probably going berserk because he's sort of suggesting that the liberal international order is not one which has been so successful. But I feel that it's wrong to call him isolationist. I do think he shares something, and you mentioned this, Rich, with his European counterparts, Le Pen, for example, the head of UKIP, the right-wing nationalist party in Britain. There's a kind of sovereignty on steroids. There's this defense of the borders. And in that context, I have to say, Josh, the idea of the people versus the powerful, you know, there was a menacing kind of through line in the speech, law and order, borders. He didn't do the Muslim registry or deportations, but it was a coded reference to it and a subset of this speech.
You know, there was a lot of unifying notes in it, and they tend to get forgotten because his speaking style is just to be a relentless sledgehammer. So you really have to read it to catch some of the stuff because it's easy to overlook. But he presents the nation as a cause of unity and patriotism mm-hmm. as unity. And there's no prejudice in patriotism, he said. And on the foreign policy, I think he went beyond, if you take some of these lines seriously, from beyond realism to another place, which is really a zero-sum view of international relations where other countries have been parasitic to the United States' interests and wealth. And that's something, a view that's kind of unique to Donald Trump. But at the same time, he said, you know, we're going to reinforce our old alliances and build new ones. Mm-hmm. So on a lot of this, there's a certain vagueness where you don't really know where he's going to come down when it comes to governing.
And I think you have awfully acute hearing if you hear dog whistles to racism in that speech. I mean, there was an explicit passage, as Rich said, about how in our patriotism we have no prejudice. I thought he was trying to get rid of the dog whistles. Just because you say you want to enforce the border does not mean you want a Muslim registry.
No, I agree. I think to a certain extent, I agree. I mean, he used the word solidarity, right? I mean, in the context of let's come together. It was not a kumbaya speech, but that is not Donald Trump. It was interesting to me just on a different level. He didn't reach out to anyone in his party, it seemed to me. I mean, it was very much, though, his last major speech, the RNC speech, it was all I. You remember, I will fix, my voice. This one, someone really got to him. I mean, it was all you, this is your country, for you know. But I still felt there was some coded language, and there was the requisite nod to eradicating radical Islamic terrorism immediately or soon in our lifetime, which is about as fantastical an idea as Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, going to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian crisis quickly.
But on other Republicans not sounding like this, one line I was struck by, he said literally that the value of the homes of middle-class Americans was stolen by the elites and redistributed around the world. There is no other elected Republican, except for maybe one or two that I'm not aware of, right, in the entire country who speak in those terms. So that really gets to what a radical change Trump could be attempting to forge.
But wait a minute, Rich. You had the day before this inaugural, or a couple days earlier, you had the testimony of Steve Mnuchin, his Treasury Secretary, who's the foreclosure king, right? I mean, good words from Donald Trump, because they are populist. And I believe in populism, though, right-wing populism less so. But come on, Steve Mnuchin is going to implement this fairness of taking care of middle-class homes, which he's foreclosed on a lot in California.
I want to touch on one other thing before we go to break, and then after the break we'll talk about the issue of Donald Trump keeping his promises and what that will look like. It's sort of in the question of how inclusive was this speech. He kept using the phrase, our people. Now, at other times, he spoke very specifically about American citizens. He talked about how, you know, black and brown and white, we're all citizens together. But I feel like a lot of people listen to Donald Trump and hear our people and wonder whether they are included in the set our people. And now, of course, I'm sure what he would say if you asked is, well, I'm talking about the entire American citizenry. But I really feel like the speech and all of his speeches are sort of this Rorschach test where people hear him talk and they make their own decisions about whether they're in the in-group or the out-group that he's talking about.
I was struck by a different divide, which is that when he talks about you, he doesn't say we. So he's never including himself with the people. It's a weird quality that in a lot of Miller's rhetoric there is, which is you talk to the workers as if they're an other.
There's also just the unifying notes. One, I think they would have been more prominent if at the beginning he had said, look, I understand a lot of people are worried about me as president. And I know, you know, there was a lot of hot rhetoric during the campaign. But, you know, this is what I'm saying to reassure you. Instead, it was kind of sprinkled in there. And two, there was no really American civic religion in this at all. We're going to send one of our interns to go look back at the last inaugural speech that didn't mention the founding fathers
or
the Declaration or the Constitution, which if he had spoken in those terms, it also might have been hit the ears of his adversaries a little differently.
I was struck by Trump on government. Tell me I'm wrong, but I mean, he in saying D.C.'s the swamp, which it is in many ways, but he's basically saying, let's take a hammer to it, let's wreck it, let's dismantle it, because it's not serving you. But, you know, Franklin Roosevelt in 1938, not an inaugural speech, but he said, government is ourselves and not an alien power over us. It seems that Trump is part of the conservative movement in the sense of reviling government, and our role, it seems to me, our role being progressives, people who care about improving the conditions of people's lives, is to retrieve government, clean it up, not dismantle it.
I don't think he reviles government, though. I mean, he was talking about government rebuilding our roads and bridges and airports and government protecting you from imports. So, again, there's overlap with the Republican agenda, but it's far from complete.
Yeah, what is the swamp, then? I mean, the swamp is a corrupt government, which we all agree is not going to serve people well. But there's more of a wrecking crew. As you look at the cabinet again, that cabinet is, you got a lot of people who have contempt for the very agencies they're about to run or don't remember, now they remember the agency they're going to run and its mission. So in that, you do see a contempt for government.
Better than a bunch of lobbyists from the swamp.
Some of them are one and the same, Mickey.
I mean, when I hear him talk about returning power to the people, I feel like that can mean a lot of things. And I don't think it necessarily means shrinking government. He's also been around this, not in the address, but saying things about we're going to take care of everybody and everybody's going to have health insurance. He ran the campaign against the idea of cuts to Medicare. And as Rich notes, often his ideas about how to protect people have a fairly expansive vision about what government will be and what it will do. I also think Donald Trump enjoys his own power. And I think that once he runs the government, whatever commitment he had to shrinking the power and control that exists within the presidency is likely to wither away. So I think, and we'll get to this after the break, in terms of Donald Trump keeping his promises, I think that Paul Ryan may actually have quite a bit to fear here. Let us know what you thought about Donald Trump's inaugural address on our Facebook page or message our Twitter account. That's at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, keeping Donald Trump's big promises. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Back again with Inauguration Weekend Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Katrina VandenHeuvel of The Nation magazine. And Mickey Kaus, longtime political blogger at KausFiles.com, is also with us. So as I watched the inaugural speech, the thing that struck me most was how big the promises were and how much Donald Trump's posture is going to have to shift now that he is president. He's spent 19 months telling us how terrible everything is, and now it's his job to make things better. So what does accountability look like for him, and how long does he have before he needs to start declaring that he's made America great again? And are the people who voted for him, in many cases with very real grievances about economic stagnation or disorder in their communities, when will they buy it when he says that he's made America great again? Mickey, what are you looking for as you grade Donald Trump as he actually does stuff?
I think he's already declared he's made America great again just with the jobs that have been promised to America before he even became president. He's gifted with an improving economy, so he's a little obsolete in thinking that there's less misery now than there was 6 months ago or a year ago. So he can basically just take credit for the economic growth, the momentum that he's inheriting. But I think he's in a good position, and if it just keeps getting better, I think in 2 years he'll be able to crow about it.
Rich, do you think that's right? I mean, the economy's been growing for 7+ years now, and there still seems to be a lot of discontent out there. I sort of don't feel like he can preside over the status quo and declare victory and be taken seriously.
Yeah, I think the most important metric is sustained wage growth. He delivers that. And very little else will matter. You know, he could take emoluments from a foreign government in the middle of Fifth Avenue, and it wouldn't matter. So the downside risk here is, according to all the polling over the last week, he comes in at a historically low numbers for a new president. You know, 40%, maybe below. And usually you don't accrue political capital in the course of the first year, which is dominated by, you know, hard-fought legislative battles. So what if he's at 30, you know, or even 35 a year from now, and Republicans are going into the midterm with a president with very low approval ratings, which is usually the key determinant of how midterms go. On the other hand, it may be that his approval rating just will never be particularly high because of the way he behaves. And it might be kind of the obverse dynamic we saw with Obama, where his approval rating was high because kind of people like him. He's winsome. He has a wonderful smile, beautiful family, and all of that. But they didn't like the results or the agenda enough to want to give him a de facto third term. And we see in some of these polls, even people don't approve of Trump, they're optimistic about what he'll do with the economy.
I think in 2018, I think health care is going to be a big issue. The unraveling of Obamacare may set up a fight. Rich may follow this more closely between congressional leaders and Trump, who's promised no cuts to Social Security, Medicare. You got Republican governors rising up in a number of states, don't want to see Medicaid shrunk, made block granted. And I think for Democrats, for progressives, you know, legislators are electoral creatures whose main concern is reelection. With that in mind, the key to successfully holding a president accountable is to create, in 2018 and beyond, enough grassroots pressure on Congress at the local level so that members fear that supporting the White House will threaten their own electoral future. I think, as I said earlier, you know, you got this cabinet, you got plans on the block for tax cuts for the very richest. What's going to happen with trade? Will he be able to bring jobs back, even with all the rolling back of regulations going on after the inauguration? Will he be able to do the infrastructure program in a way that really does sustain wage growth, create jobs? If not, you could see, if it's deftly handled, a turning against Trump and this double cross idea I talked about earlier.
But as columnist Byron York pointed out, Trump is perfectly positioned to triangulate against Congress. In other words, he can say, I'm the guy who's saving your health insurance against Paul Ryan, who wants to take it away, and Paul Ryan wants to take away your Medicare, and I'm defending you. And that puts him in a very good position.
There's sort of a weird double thing here with Trump on healthcare, which is one is that he seems acutely aware of the political risks that the healthcare issue poses to him. He issued this warning to Republicans about not to create a situation where they can be blamed for the deterioration of the healthcare market. He seems to understand that if a lot of people lose health insurance, that will be bad for him politically. On the other hand, he can't seem to restrain himself from making big grand promises like that we're going to cover everyone and that he's going to replace Obamacare with something terrific and it's going to be much cheaper and better. And you've seen other Republicans in Washington trying to roll out these new talking points about how it's not insurance for everyone, it's access to affordable insurance for everyone. They can't get Trump to parrot those talking points. I think he's been used throughout his career to making big promises and, you know, saying that he was going to build the world's tallest building on the west side of Manhattan and then not getting in any particular trouble when he doesn't follow through on the promises. And so I think that's where his downfall could be on healthcare. I think he knows he has to deliver something big, but he can't bring himself to promise something that he can actually deliver.
You know, but the other thing, here's the what we haven't talked about, the symbolism, the spectacle. Steve Bannon clearly was involved with his speech. Things go south. Trump can do a victory, quote, victory tour every 2 weeks. It's bread and circuses. It's spectacle. That can take him a long way, especially in a recovering economy, as Rich mentioned. That's, you know, unhappy because it's not accountability. It's not promises acted on, but it'll get him pretty far.
So what's the strategy for everybody else in Washington right now? Because I was really struck by this contrast today where you had Trump give this speech. There's basically a rejection of both political parties, of an establishment that he was painting as corrupt. He got up there, thanked all these former presidents, and then basically talked about what an awful job they had done. And then minutes later, you have all these people crowded around Trump as he signs the first orders of his presidency, formally nominating the people that he's nominated to the cabinet. And they're all like laughing and he's handing out the signing pens. And, you know, Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi are excitedly receiving these signing pens from President Trump. And it sort of looks like it's, you know, it's back to politics as usual in Washington with people on both sides making nice with each other. And I'm unsure whether those two things can go together. And my guess is that they actually can, that Donald Trump can go out there and talk about how horrible everyone is and then actually get together and make at least some agreements on policy with these people and be nice to them indoors while he's decrying them outdoors.
I think Paul Ryan's strategy is to stay as close to Trump as possible. So every time we were talking about healthcare, every time Trump tweets or says in an interview, we're going to cover everyone and it's going to be repeal and replace at the same time, you know, Ryan's calling him saying, you know, what do you mean by that? And let's try not to do this publicly. Let's do it, you know, on the tax plan. Trump criticized an aspect of the Ryan tax plan the other day. You know, Ryan immediately calls him. Let's talk about this behind closed doors. So the congressional Republicans are trying not to let that space that Mickey said potentially can develop between Trump and the congressional party grow. And Schumer is just going to oppose him at every turn. Now, maybe a few things will be difficult for him to do that, a big infrastructure program, maybe some of Trump's trade agenda. Otherwise, it's just going to be complete opposition from the beginning.
I thought the most interesting story of the week was the story that Steve Bannon, who despises Paul Ryan and is the nationalist wing of the Trump group, is cooperating with Ryan to get his tax plan done as quickly as possible. And I think Bannon's thinking must be, let's get Ryan's stuff over with quickly so we can get to my stuff later.
I don't see opposition. I'm not looking inside the Beltway for opposition. I think that you're going to see opposition cities, communities, states around this country, and strong measures, because they will be actionable. They will be real. There will be real improvements in the conditions of people's lives. The trick is to message that nationally. And for people inside Washington who are not going to be able to do much, I'm talking about the Democrats, to connect with those outside, there will be movement energy. It needs to be savvy and smart and effective and not just resistance. It needs to connect inside, outside to really drive some real policy changes. But I do think you saw the other day Attorney General Schneiderman in New York, you know, on the sanctuaries, he's going to do some voting rights things. California will be a place, but so will other cities, communities around this country.
I was interested that one of the very first policy statements that came out from the Trump White House was on trade. I mean, obviously, this isn't unexpected. Trump talks about trade all the time. It seems to be one of the issues that he has genuinely cared about and had roughly the same position on for several decades, saying they're going to formally withdraw from TPP negotiations and that the and that they will go and renegotiate NAFTA and withdraw from it if necessary. And I think that's going to test the proposition that Rich put out here about Republicans in Congress hugging Donald Trump very closely, because this is an issue that he could set out very early to do something that they, I think, have fairly strong ideological opposition to. It would also be something that could likely unsettle the financial markets that have been giving Donald Trump a lift over the last couple of months. And so that, I think, is going to be an interesting stress test for Trump and Republicans. If he leads with something that they really don't like and it ends up moving the economy in a way that people don't like, I think that could strain their ability to make nice with each other.
Yeah, and I imagine he will, because, you know, you look at General Mattis, and this is a very conventional Republican intention with a lot of what Trump has said over the last 18 months. But the trade team is fully Trumpist. They are hardcore. I imagine we're going to see some tariffs against someone fairly quickly out of the box, because, one, Trump believes it, and, two, after threatening and talking about it for so long, if he doesn't follow through on it, he'll be seen as a complete paper tagger, whereas as part of his economic program is actively threatening businesses to try to get them to do what he wants. And if they don't believe him, you know, anything he says from a year from now, he loses some of his bully pulpit.
He sort of needs an air traffic controller strike to break to show that he really means it early in his term the way Reagan did.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Mickey Kaus, what's on your mind?
Katrina mentioned the need for creativity on the left. How about some recriminations? It seems to me every other time that Democrats have lost, there have been pointed recriminations, rethinking, neoliberalism, DLC type, Bill Clintonism. I don't see any of that now, and I think it's the loss is too painful for the Democrats. They're humiliated, and also the current landscape where you prosper by whipping up your troops on the web recrimination doesn't pay. So we're seeing a total absence of any sort of introspection on the left.
Rich Lowry.
John Lewis boycotted the inauguration, which he portrayed as a radical departure for him, when actually he had boycotted both of George W. Bush's inaugurations. In fact, the only Republican inauguration he's ever attended as a congressman is George H.W. Bush's. I think it's important for people to realize that two things can be true about John Lewis. He can be a true American hero and at the same time be a completely reflexive partisan.
Katrina Vandenhoevel.
I want to nod to the Women's March. 200,000 plus women, men, children gather, assemble in defense and support of the best of American values. And it's worth remembering that there will be marches around the globe as well, and in 600 cities, towns, communities in this country. It is about perfecting the union, making it more just, the eternal struggle, especially now.
For my rant, I got married on Saturday. So that was very exciting. And, you know, love is probably the most important thing in the world. And to the extent that we don't all die in some nuclear war, that will continue to be true in the Trump administration. So we talk about politics every week on this show, and politics is important. But I am taking some time to reflect on the many joys that I have in my life, including my love and my marriage that is ahead of me. Zach, I love you. I will be off the next 2 weeks for my honeymoon, so I will be missing the first 2 weeks of the Donald Trump administration, which I am terribly broken up about. But Kelly Goff will be here guest hosting for you, ably leading you through that time, and I will be back on February 10th. That is all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Katrina Vandenhoevel, and Mickey Kaus. Laura Dine Million produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.